From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And President Trump is scheduled to hold a press conference at the White House this afternoon to talk about the coronavirus. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said today that 45 states have reported infections. But the epicenter of the pandemic right now is really Europe. In Italy, at least 15,000 people have reportedly tested positive. That's the most cases outside of China, and more than 1,000 people have died. In the United Kingdom, health officials are monitoring the growing number of cases there. And NPR's Frank Langfitt joins us from London. And Frank, the government there is trying to delay the worst onset of the coronavirus until summer. Can you tell us exactly what that means?
Yeah, it's a really interesting strategy that Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, laid out yesterday. And what he's talking about is he doesn't want to put in these social distancing policies that we've seen in many other countries, shutting down schools, things like that, until he thinks the virus is really going to take off. And part of his argument is he's afraid if he starts now, there'll be a lot of fatigue and people won't follow it. The other problem here is our National Health Service has been wildly underfunded for years, and he's afraid of overloading it very quickly. So what he wants to do is kind of flatten out these cases over many months. And this is how he described it yesterday when he was talking to the nation.
If we delay the peak even by a few weeks, then our NHS will be in a stronger state as the weather improves and fewer people suffer from normal respiratory diseases, more beds are available, and we'll have more time for medical research.
This actually sounds kind of controversial. What's the reaction to this strategy?
There is concern if you talk to ordinary people here as well as epidemiologists. What the government seems to be saying is it knows that it cannot handle a big onslaught. But ordinary people are wondering, why aren't we shutting things down now? We've seen in France they're closing schools. Obviously, this has already happened in Italy some time ago. And in Ireland, with which the United Kingdom shares a border, they've closed down schools and universities yesterday. So the UK seems to be an outlier.
Are there public health officials that have spoken out about this?
Oh, yeah. Now, there's been some support for the prime minister. Keith Neal, he's with the University of Nottingham, an emeritus professor in epidemiology. He calls this sensible. But there's also been a lot of criticism. Richard Horton, he's the chief editor of The Lancet, the famous medical journal. His quote, and this is a powerful one, he says, "The government is playing roulette with the public. This is a major error."
You mentioned that folks there who live and work every day are kind of wondering what's next. What have you heard, at least anecdotally or from the folks that you've spoken to, about how they're feeling about this measure?
I think, you know, right now the trains are full of people. People are still going to work, but there's a lot of anxiety, uncertainty, and questioning the policies of the government. I can tell you my kids go to an international school which does have British kids, does have a lot of European kids. They're going to be shutting down early. They're basically making their own decision to shut down next week. Kids are already leaving. So last night I was at a school play and boarders, people who boarded the school were walking. I ran into one walking through the parking lot with all of her luggage heading back to continental Europe. And some people don't want to put their kids in school actually at the beginning of this week. They're going to pull them early. So there's a lot of division and anxiety about this and uncertainty about whether the government's doing the right thing.
That's NPR's Frank Langfitt. He joins us from London. Thank you so much for this update.
You're very welcome, Tanya.
There's been a mad dash of Americans trying to get out of parts of Europe after President Trump announced travel restrictions to the United States from 26 European countries. And here in the U.S., American airline companies are now putting protocols in place for people who want to cancel existing flights overseas and within the country. We wanted to get some clarity on how to do that. And joining us now is Christopher Elliott. He's a consumer advocate, and he joins us now from Nice, France. Chris, welcome.
Hi.
So you're there for work. Tell us what you're seeing there. What's the level of concern about the coronavirus?
Well, France is preparing for a surge in coronavirus cases. The French president got on TV last night and said that the schools and universities were going to be closed starting on Monday. Here in Nice, people have greeted the news kind of with a very French collective shrug. People are still out enjoying the cafes and the restaurants, and they're out sunbathing on the beaches at the Mediterranean. So it's very much, I don't want to say business as usual, but it's not panic.
Yeah, yeah. And I know that you're there for work and you were planning to travel to Italy, but now Italy is a red zone, so you won't be doing that. I want to talk a little bit about the airlines and if it's even possible to get a refund for tickets right now.
Yeah, well, I should probably start by saying that the refund policies are changing by the minute. But generally, if your flight is canceled, you're going to get a full refund. If you want to cancel your ticket for a flight in March or April, most of the major airlines are waiving their change fee. So they usually charge a change fee, and now they've decided not to do that. But they're also offering refunds on a case-by-case basis. And this is interesting. If you can make a case that you either can't fly or you wouldn't be able to use a credit, I think the airlines are much more receptive now to that than they've ever been. So you can definitely try doing that. I also list all of the names and phone numbers and email addresses for the executives at the airlines on my consumer advocacy site. That's Elliott.org. And you can try reaching out to one of them. That's also been known to work.
I want to ask you about hotels. What kind of refunds are they offering?
A lot of hotels have refundable rates. And so chances are if you have a hotel reservation, it is refundable already. If you cancel within 24 to 48 hours. But hotels also have something called a prepaid rate, and that is non-refundable. And they've just recently, in the last 24 hours, started loosening their policies. Really good example of that is Hilton, which just this morning announced that for guests that do not have a refundable rate, so they have a non-cancelable rate, if they want to cancel their reservation scheduled for arrival before April 30th, they can do that at no charge. So that was kind of a new thing where the hotels are, I think, trying to be a little bit more consumer friendly.
So much to think about. Thank you so much for laying all of this out with us. That's Christopher Elliott, a consumer advocate joining us from Nice, France.
Thank you very much.
Well, financial markets continued their roller coaster ride this morning with a surge in early trading. Investors are hoping that Congress is close to getting a stimulus package on the president's desk. Let's hear from Mike Regan. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, so far, at least today, a glimmer of relief. The Dow up now 2.5%. What are you seeing?
Well, right. You're right. There is a little bit of a bounce back today. There's some renewed hope that the government, Congress, will be able to get an agreement on a bill that they'll be able to pass. Yesterday, there was a lot of concern that maybe politics would get in the way. Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats had worked on a big relief package, but there was a lot of pushback from Republicans. Today, there is a little bit of optimism that they will be able to get an agreement ready this week. I will say, though, that you know, as far as the market's concerned, it's doubtful that the government, anything that government can do right now, will be a sort of panacea that fixes all the economic damage being done, and therefore give the market enough confidence to really start rallying again. I mean, we're bound to see this type of volatility up and back down continue for the foreseeable future, simply because there's so much economic damage being done right now from this virus.
Well, that's a good point, because yesterday the stock market had its biggest one-day drop since 1987, and there was government stimulus involved yesterday. It was not calmed by the Fed's decision to inject $1.5 trillion into the banking system. So why have investors been so immune to these stimulus measures up until this morning, it appears?
Right. Well, the Fed's main focus is that there's just this massive demand for cash right now for the U.S. dollar, because the corporate bond markets are basically ground to a halt, so that companies are going to banks to tap those emergency credit lines. You know, it's like one of us going and sort of maxing out our credit card because we're afraid about our cash flow going forward. So that's really just caused an enormous amount of pressure for banks and corporations to sort of hoard the dollar. So what the Fed did is try to relieve that pressure, which was very acute in money markets. And there are signs that it is helping to do that. Again, even that is not going to be a sort of this miracle cure-all for the massive economic damage being done. It's just beyond, it's an unprecedented risk to the economy basically right now when you see so many things closing down. I mean, the NBA suspending, the ban on flights to Europe, or at least the severe restrictions on them. I mean, we've never really experienced this type of shock to the economy before, and I think the government, you know, and the Federal Reserve, they're going to do the best they can as quickly as they can, but it's hard to imagine them being able to really counteract all of the problems that we're going to see in the next few weeks and months. You know, the government simply can't replace all the lost sales and profits of all the companies in the country, regardless of what they're able to agree on.
So quickly, Mike, when then are we going to see some actual data about how hard this is actually hitting the economy?
Well, I think, you know, the earliest thing to look at here is the weekly jobless claims. They just tally up how many people are filing for unemployment insurance across the country. Surprisingly, this week they remained very low in that sort of low 200,000 level. The expectation is that they should start picking up, and I think that will give you sort of a sense of how swiftly the damage is being done.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor of Bloomberg News. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This week on NPR's Invisibilia, we take you to a summer program for teenagers with sleepovers, marshmallows, and racial confrontation.
I want you to all line up by skin tone, lightest to darkest.
That's up next on NPR's Invisibilia.
Time for a look at social media with Femi Okay. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, what a week, huh?
Oh, my goodness. So much to talk about. Yeah. And also, people were talking about the coronavirus. Obviously, all of our feeds are full of that on social. But there are other stories out there, too.
We're going to get there. We're going to get to the coronavirus. But why don't we start with some of those headlines that are like we're not noticing, right? What about Chelsea Manning? A judge has ordered the former Army intelligence analyst at the center of the WikiLeaks scandal to be released from jail. What are you seeing there?
I just wanted to do a quick recap on Chelsea Manning. She originally had that 35-year sentence commuted by President Obama, taken back into custody last year for refusing to testify before the grand jury investigating WikiLeaks. And then her legal team revealed this week that she tried to take her own life. And then the announcement of her release came very shortly after from a detention centre in Virginia. So let me tell you what I am seeing. The judge says that she still has to pay her fines. There are a number of anti-trans comments about her personal life, about her personal lifestyle decisions, little sympathy for the fine. That is the pushback, the critics. Also, a lot of love and empathy for Chelsea Manning. Immediately, there's a GoFundMe campaign. The last time I looked, there was over $70,000 in that. Hmm. Her fines will be up to $250,000.
Right, I was just going to say, that's a lot of money.
That's not bad.
No, that's a lot
That's
of money.
In just a few hours. And then Edward Snowden, a well-known whistleblower, he summed up what happened to Chelsea Manning in the last 10 months. They offered to let her out in exchange for collaboration, but she chose her principles instead. This is moral strength, and a lot of people out there online saying this should never have happened. This is torture.
All right, we're going to keep an eye on that story, but of course, coronavirus, we promised to talk about it. We should talk about it. The spread of it is now global. People around the world are getting creative to work around China's tight monitoring of social media to learn more about what's happening in Wuhan, where the outbreak started. They're using Tinder, Femi, the dating app.
I am just going to say I know about this because I'm a journalist and I'm researching. But there is a premium Tinder subscription which allows you to reach out beyond borders, beyond your neighborhood. And the hashtag for this is Love in the Time of Corona. For instance, you can reach out to Laughing26. That's a doctor who works at the Wuhan Union Hospital. Looks very lovely. He's wearing a mask. He's green scrubs. And he is talking about life in Wuhan, when there was the very, very severe lockdown. He says everything is on lockdown. Traffic, work, society, even lovemaking. I'm going to use that euphemism there. Doesn't quite use that because remember, this is Tinder. And what people are finding in their Tinder connections is rather than doing the normal sort of dating backwards and forth, they're actually asking questions like, how do you know when you're free of the coronavirus? And the doctor's talking about antibodies and how you live your life and what you need to do and suggestions for how you manage your isolation. So this is the sort of conversations that you rarely see on Tinder. And it's a really interesting way to maybe get around the way that China has quite a very severe monitoring policy of social media, and Tinder subscribers have managed to break that. Although now that we've been talking about it and sharing it, I suspect they will find a way to lock down love in the time of corona.
That is interesting. And to be clear, these are not necessarily romantic exchanges. People are just going to exchange information.
They are fascinated as to what it is like to live in Wuhan province, which of course is where we first learned about the coronavirus.
Look, I don't want to minimize the severity of what's happening, but we need a little bit of relief here. Disco queen Gloria Gaynor has something to say about all this. A little tongue-in-cheek, I guess, but there is a video trending of her washing her hands to her own song. It is a moment of levity, and people love it.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Gloria Gaynor is in time to her own music. She's pumping the soap, lathering up her hands, putting the water just in the right pace with the little head nods as we're going through that disco classic. People are loving it. Thousands of people have retweeted it. A little bit of a debate because she keeps the tap running as she's doing the song. And people who have water shortages are saying, Miss Gaynor, you really should turn the tap off. But then, of course, this is Twitter and you can debate anything. Other people are saying, of course, if she's cleaning up her hands, she cannot turn the tap off until she's cleaned up her hands, because then she will put germs back onto her hands. But I do recommend you go to @GloriaGaynor to see this video. That track will stick in your head for the rest of the day. But what a beautiful one to go through Friday.
It's a very different feeling than like Happy Birthday, which I tell my four-year-old to sing to herself two times before she stops washing her hands. Maybe we should switch to I Will Survive.
A little bit of disco. All right. Never goes amiss.
Femi OK, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
If you're stuck in the house, distancing yourself from others because of coronavirus, why not catch up on some quality television? NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us with his picks to take your mind off of the virus. Hey, Eric.
Hey.
Okay, so let's start with some upbeat sitcoms. There's NBC's Parks and Recreation and The Good Place, which just wrapped up last month. We have a clip here from The Good Place, which is about the hijinks in the afterlife.
Somebody royally forked up. Somebody forked up. Why can't I say fork?
If you're trying to curse, you can't hear. I guess a lot of people in this neighborhood don't like it, so it's prohibited.
That's bullshit.
I know that The Good Place is one of your favorites, and along with Parks and Recreation, they're both on Hulu and Netflix. What makes these shows ideal viewing in times like these?
Well, The Good Place, you know, it's ultimately this series about what does it mean to have chosen family, the power of friendship, and choosing to be good. What does it mean to realize that you're flawed and to choose to be good? And that's all the subtext that's behind just this really funny sitcom that has great actors in it, from Kristen Bell to Ted Danson. And then there's Parks and Recreation, which is just this really great comedy about the ultimate optimist. I got to say, you know, Leslie Knope, the lead character, is somebody who really believes in the power of government. She really believes in it, the ability to sort of make people's lives better. But she's surrounded by this dysfunctional crew of people who make that very difficult for her. So we've got a clip that features Aziz Ansari, who plays somebody who works in the office. And we get to learn about his signature trademark phrase, which is treat yourself. So let's check it out.
Once a year, Donna and I spend a day treating ourselves. What do we treat ourselves to?
Clothes.
Treat yourself.
Fragrances.
Treat yourself.
Massages.
Treat yourself.
Mimosas.
Treat yourself.
Fine leather goods.
Treat yourself.
It's the best day of the year.
The best day of the year.
That's my new tagline is treat yourself.
I was going to say, I'm not going to tell you how long I went around saying, treat yourself, treat yourself.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, just that is enough to make you laugh. So, you know, between Parks and Rec and The Good Place, you got two really great comedies where the subtext of what they're talking about is also kind of heartening and may make you feel a little better in these times.
You know, one thing I always love to do on New Year's Eve is watch the Twilight Zone marathon. So there's some classics also on your list.
Oh, yeah. And you know, I'm a sci-fi geek, so of course I love The Twilight Zone as well. But the show that I really liked, well, let's hear a little clip and then everybody, I think, will know what I'm talking about.
To boldly go where no one has gone before.
To Yeah, that's the theme for Star Trek The Next Generation. And, you know, being a sci-fi geek, I just really love the message of this show. This takes place at a time when we've already survived a Third World War. There's no money. Earth is united under a single government that respects everyone and everyone's equal, and all this stuff about racism and sexism is supposedly in our past. And we're reaching out in the stars to try and form an alliance amongst other alien races. And one of the things I noticed, I started watching it because I was also watching a show on CBS All Access, an update of the character Jean-Luc Picard from Next Generation called Star Trek Picard. So I watched the old episodes and I started to realize how good the best episodes really were. They still kind of hold up. Hmm. Or you can go to CBS All Access and you can watch the modernized sort of continuation of that story called Star Trek Picard, where once again it raises all these questions about, you know, what kind of society do we want to build? Mm-hmm. And how do we build a world where everyone is equal? Another great message to consider in these times.
Okay, so all of your recommendations so far are optimistic and funny. What if that's not your cup of tea? You have any other recommendations?
Okay, well, in addition to being a sci-fi geek, I'm also a Western geek. So I really like Westerns. And so,
all kinds of geek.
Exactly. There's many shades of geek here. And I particularly love the modernized Western that was called Justified that aired on FX. It's gained a home on Hulu. There were 5 seasons of it. And it's centered on this character named Raylan Givens, who's sort of like a modern-day lawman. He's a U.S. Marshal. And he has a penchant for shooting people. And we even have a scene where he's stuck with his lawyer and a prosecutor trying to figure out what happened when he had to draw down on somebody. So let's check it out.
Would you like to make a statement?
The marshal's office has conducted an internal investigation of the proceedings that occurred at the hotel in question on...
Well, let's just keep it simple, huh?
He pulled first. I shot him.
There you go. So that scene happened in Miami. He was a marshal in Miami. As punishment, he gets sent back to his hometown. And he sort of falls into all these people that he has a history with. So in the same way that you might pick up an old Western novel, you could go back and watch these episodes and feel like you're kind of settling into a story that will distract you from what's going on right now.
Lots of options for that. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. As always, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
President Trump is scheduled to hold a press conference on the coronavirus at 3 p.m. Eastern this afternoon. One of the things he's expected to talk about is an emergency aid package that might provide some relief for people feeling the economic impact of COVID-19. The administration has been working on that with congressional leaders. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales joins us now. And Claudia, what can you tell us? What's in this aid package?
Well, they're looking at several elements to try and address all these new economic woes that we have from this outbreak. One of those that it's specifically centered on is addressing paid sick leave for a lot of these workers who lose time at their jobs as a result of this. And so they want to cover those workers that don't have that kind of coverage right now as a result of anything connected to this coronavirus illness. So that's one key element. Another one is food security for children who could lose it if their schools close down. We're seeing numerous reports around the country of school districts closing down, and a lot of these kids still need to get food, so they want to make sure they fund that. Another issue is unemployment insurance. They want to make sure that that is covered. And there's other elements as well, such as a boost in masks for public health officials and other details they want to try and cover during the period this outbreak continues to spread.
Claudia, I'm not sure if you know this or not yet, but are these temporary measures or would these be more permanent?
So these measures are focused on the time period of the outbreak. So if we do see a slow in the illness, say come this summer, then that would be a trigger for a lot of these benefits to come to a slow as well or to get halted. So they're really right now trying to craft this around that timeline of the outbreak, which is uncertain, but they're trying to tie it to that now if possible.
To what extent is this a bipartisan effort and both parties coming together?
Well, it's really coming down to that right now because the negotiations really are between House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. He is working on behalf of the Trump administration and Republicans to try and get this deal sorted out with the speaker. And so that's the key right now, is trying to get a bipartisan agreement on the House floor. And that is in part why it's been held up for so many hours since yesterday. We've been at this really long wait to see if they can reach a deal. It seems like if it's not bipartisan, it's not going to get much movement at all.
Well, yesterday's cascade of news was just remarkable with all the cancellations that we saw, the historic drop in the stock market. You've got to figure these lawmakers and the White House under tremendous pressure.
Yeah, they are under tremendous pressure. They're on the edge of quite the crisis right now and trying to make some very difficult decisions on how to address what we've seen already and what's to come. There's a lot of unknowns here of still what is to come here and how to address it. These lawmakers themselves are dealing with uncertainties. There's more than half a dozen who have had to self-quarantine themselves. So the clock is really ticking on them to make these tough decisions soon.
Do you have a rough timetable?
It's tough. We have been in a guessing game. That is the big question right now. We know how Speaker Nancy Pelosi has announced she's finally going to give some sort of an update this afternoon, actually in the next few minutes at 2 p.m. Eastern. So we're very curious what she'll have to say. Then President Trump will be giving his own address later today. So we know we'll have a better picture if the impasse will continue,
right,
or whether they can strike a deal in the next few hours.
NPR's Claudia Grisales, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
There's a lot of misinformation floating around about the coronavirus. Everything from fake news articles about populations of people who are supposedly immune to dangerous home remedies. And for more on the facts, we have with us Dr. Seema Yasmin. She's a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Stanford University and author of the forthcoming book, Debunked. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Seema, let's get right to those bogus claims. Here's one, that the coronavirus is man-made.
That is not true. And interestingly, Tanya, we hear this kind of conspiracy theory with almost every epidemic. We heard it during Zika. We heard it during Ebola. What we do know is that it's very likely that this coronavirus jumped from bats to another animal and then to humans.
Okay, there's also been lots of info floating around about home remedies, as I mentioned. One really dangerous one, drinking bleach. Can you dispel some of those myths around home remedies?
Yeah, please don't ever, ever, for any reason, consume bleach. That is so dangerous and can be fatal. I mean, often with a lot of home remedies, Tanya, they're not so bad. They're not going to do any harm. For example, we may have heard about like gargling with salt water, drinking lots of warm water. While those things won't directly kill a virus, including the new coronavirus, they're also not going to do you any harm. But I do worry about those ones that are potentially deadly, like drinking bleach. And that hoax went viral very early on in this epidemic. And just want to make clear, it does not protect you from coronavirus. Do not drink bleach.
There's also been a lot of fake articles out there floating around about Black people being immune to coronavirus. What's the truth here?
We have no evidence about there being any higher level of protection among Black people or any particular group of people. I will say that, especially within the United States, I worry more about Black people and people of color becoming infected, because it's not just the virus that kills us, it's poor access to healthcare. It's having poor health insurance. And there are so many studies that show that Black people, people of color, people on the margins of society have a harder time getting the appropriate treatment and getting that on time. So it can be misleading and almost dangerous to think that because of the color of your skin, you have an added level of protection to this new infection.
I want to get back to some other things that we have heard about remedies or ways to tell if you have the virus or not. Something that made the rounds this week and initially actually fooled some folks on our team was this viral email supposedly from a medical board member. Let's debunk some of what was said. First, is it true that if you have a runny nose, you have the common cold and do not need to worry?
That is not true. We know that the symptoms of infection with this new coronavirus include cough, fever, tightness in the chest, shortness of breath, but it can also include a runny nose. And we've seen that from these large studies coming out of China, including both adults and children. So just because you have a runny nose, that doesn't help us in any way narrow down exactly which infection you have. And it could mean that you have infection with the new coronavirus.
There's this other one that brings up another interesting point that I'd love for you to clarify for us. There was one about if someone sneezes, it takes about 10 feet before it hits the ground and it's no longer airborne. This brings up the question, what is a safe distance to be from someone who has the virus? And is there truly a safe distance?
So when somebody is infected with this virus and then they're sneezing or coughing, they release droplets in their sneezes or their coughs. And within those droplets, that's where the virus is. We've studied those droplets for other infections too, and that's how we know that really the furthest they can travel is 6 feet, which is about 2 yards.
How can people really check to see if the information they're getting about preventative measures and symptoms is accurate?
So the first thing to do, Tanya, is to stop, not immediately believe what you're seeing, and especially don't immediately share it. If it's just a forwarded email or forwarded WhatsApp message, you want to really check where did this come from. Then you want to check that alongside verified sources. So you can go to the CDC's website. You can go to the World Health Organization website. It just takes a few added steps and a pause, making sure that you can fact check this alongside verified sources and websites, and certainly don't share yourself until you feel like you know it comes from somewhere credible.
That's Dr. Seema Yasmin of Stanford University. Thank you so much for dispelling these myths for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And one other big myth we've also been hearing a lot about is that children cannot get the virus. Experts have said they believe kids are less likely to get it, but that's based on what we've seen happen in China and Korea. There is still so much we don't know. Dr. Karen Kotloff is the head of the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. And doctor, as I mentioned, there's still so much emerging about the impact of this disease on children. But based on the little bit of information that we do know, what can you tell us?
I can tell you that the information so far suggests that children are less likely to become infected, and when they do become infected, their disease tends to be less severe.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on children's ability to spread it to others? How would we know if a child is contagious if they're showing symptoms that are not as severe as possibly having a high fever or all of the symptoms that we know from COVID-19?
So I think that children present a challenge in that regard. I think that the epidemiologic patterns and the clustering that we have seen so far has suggested that most of the transmission is occurring from adult to adult, and that within households, there isn't evidence that the source of transmission to other household members is the child. Now, that situation needs to be taken within context because fewer children were exposed early in the epidemic. And so there are still a lot of things we just don't know.
We've been hearing so much about those who have pre-existing conditions are at higher risk. What about if you have a child with a pre-existing condition like asthma?
So far, the cases that have been reported in children have not had pre-existing conditions. And so I think we need to watch children who have underlying conditions very carefully. And finally, especially in the case of asthma, when you look at just the common coronavirus, that's much less commonly a trigger for asthma than, say, the most common cold virus, which is rhinovirus. And I can tell you that so far, there has not been evidence that children with asthma are more likely to get the COVID-19 coronavirus or that they would get more severe illness. But we really don't know. And the advice that I would give to parents of children who have asthma or that they should continue to manage their asthma the way they normally do. And that if they see their child having unusual symptoms, that they contact their doctor promptly.
And Dr. Kotloff, I just have one additional question for you. You know, not to spread panic in any way, but we have heard anecdotally from folks who have said, my child has a fever, my child is showing symptoms of COVID-19, and yet our doctor is telling us we can't have a test. Are you hearing those stories as well? And what should parents do if they're in that situation?
So I am hearing those questions, and I think it's related to the fact that testing, there's a limitation in the number of kits. And so I think that the bottom line here is that right now, this virus is going to be controlled with strict infection control. And so the parents just need to follow that. If their child is sick, they need to keep the child at home and avoid exposures with other people and do that for about 2 weeks. And if the child gets more severely ill or other contacts start getting sick with unusually severe symptoms, then they need to raise up that level of concern and be assertive about trying to get their children tested.
That's Dr. Karen Kotloff. She's the head of the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
We're taking a few minutes now to talk about a disease that has not been commandeering the headlines, Parkinson's disease. About 1 million Americans have it. The chronic and progressive brain disorder eventually robs patients of their ability to move. One of the most effective treatments for Parkinson's is exercise. Research shows exercise that challenges the body and the brain helps improve a patient's quality of life. Chloe Axelson from member station WBUR reports.
Randy Devitt is 63 years old. 14 years ago, he noticed something strange going on with his left hand. You know that song by Vince Guaraldi, the one from A Charlie Brown Christmas? Randy had been playing it since high school, and suddenly his left hand couldn't keep up.
I got a diagnosis out of the blue, basically. You've got Parkinson's. It was a rough couple of years, those first couple of years, mainly because all I could think of was how soon until I can't do this, I can't do that, I can't do that.
Like fighting fires. Randy's been a firefighter in Seattle for 30 years. The neighborhood kids used to call him Fireman Randy, and he was known as one of the best engine drivers in the city.
I had a soft foot, meaning that I didn't drive real herky-jerky. I was known for being able to stop really smoothly.
Because he loved his job, Randy kept his Parkinson's a secret.
I also chose not to tell anybody. I couldn't imagine the fire department letting me keep driving the fire engine if they knew I had Parkinson's.
Randy eventually gave up driving the truck in 2012, 6 years after his diagnosis. He's a fire inspector these days, and it's hard not to notice his Parkinson's. It looks like he's lugging two large suitcases when he walks, so his arms barely swing. The disease has rounded his shoulders. His voice is strong, but flat.
I used to be a really, really good talker, and now I have pauses and hiccups, and it's all in there. It just doesn't get out as smooth as it used to.
The Parkinson's brain wants to make everything smaller, slower, and more quiet. That's not Randy. When I ask him to tell me all the ways Parkinson's affects him, it takes him 2.5 minutes.
Loss of sense of smell, stiffness of muscles, restless legs, any fine motor skills, tying your shoe.
Little by little, Parkinson's will take away Randy's ability to control almost everything about his body.
Constipation, lack of facial expression.
So he's pushing back with the one thing that's been shown to slow the progress of the disease, exercise. It's better than anything else, even medicine.
Even when I'm thinking about it, it's hard to get my arms moving on a treadmill, so this is a real good exercise for me. It's challenging.
Randy works out at the Parkinson's Fitness Project. It's a gym under a restaurant right on Lake Washington. It looks like a normal gym. There's a TV, a wall of mirrors, and equipment stacked neatly all around.
All right, let's just go to 4 minutes.
4 minutes, yes, sir.
Nate Coomer opened this place 3 years ago, and his clients are all Parkinson's patients. What's unique about his approach is how he combines physical exercise with mental gymnastics.
Hey, good, keep it going.
See.
Nice big loud voice.
After Randy warms up on the treadmill, Nate runs him through a bunch of exercises. One has Randy raising an 8-pound medicine ball over his head and slamming it into the ground. With each repetition, he says every other letter of the alphabet.
So once they're done with an intensive exercise, they kind of have this boost of the ability to use dopamine better in their brain. They feel like they're able to process quicker, move faster, move bigger. In Randy's case, he's in here. He can move in so many dynamic ways. He can do so much. I see the potential he still has. I mean, I see a guy that motivates me.
Randy says he doesn't regret all the things he can't do now because he's happy to have done them. I got a lot of really good miles out of this body, he tells me.
In order to get past those first couple of years, I had to accept my mortality. I started accepting the Parkinson's and realizing that my not accepting it was getting in the way of everything I wanted to do.
Randy's retiring from the fire department at the end of the month, and when he does, he's hoping to spend a lot more time making music with his friends.
The sun is surely sinking down.
He's got some recording equipment and a baby grand piano.
But the moon is slowly rising.
I'm too hoarse.
Okay. I got the first one.
For Here and Now, I'm Chloe Axelson.
So close your eyes. You can close your eyes. It's all right. I don't know no left songs. I can't sing the blues anymore. But I can sing this song. And you can sing this song when I'm gone.
Chloe's story came to us from the Transom Traveling Workshop at KUOW in Seattle. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
COVID-19 is closing schools across the country, reminding us of an earlier time.
This is polio. Men, women, as always, especially children. Filling hospitals with its little victims.
A medical historian on the 1950s polio outbreak, next time on Here and Now.